Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disabilities who have taken from them or are denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those above them.
Disrespect welcomes to the show Ben Bishop and Bill Schmier from Community Functionality
Facilitation
Incorporated. This, believe it or not, is an arm of the government that links people up to services, among other things. We're going to talk about some of those other things tonight in relation to tax law, which is coming up for application on April 30th. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now, a lot of things have changed in the last, year and a bit about tax law. We've got the RDSP, Registered Disability Savings Plan, maybe most prominent in your mind.
Yep.
And I don't know, people would like to hear about the other things too, sort of as a package, I think.
Though there's been a huge change with regards to tax laws. Well, it comes from a choice that had to be made from accepting a whole bunch of different disability stubs or disability or disability identifications, such as pay stubs and program applications and that sort of thing, and certificates, or just kind of relaxing the disability tax credit and allowing it to include all those groups.
Because it was narrow, you had to prove your qualification.
Yes, because you had to be marketedly restricted.
Yes,
And that basically means that you had to be completely almost bedridden to get the disability tax credit, or it had to be a really, really, really limiting condition. Okay.
Or a combination of conditions.
That is correct.
Yeah. When did that come into effect, the combination of conditions?
The combination of conditions was on the forms in 2008, and they will go back to 2005.
Okay.
What it has to be is now it's each one, you can have a number of different conditions that can equal a significant impairment, not marked impairment.
Okay.
And that's found on pages 8 and 9 of the Disability Tax Credit, T2201 forms.
That qualification?
The caveat is that it can be a condition or a series of conditions that can lead to a significant impairment.
What's the difference between a marked impairment and a significant impairment?
You have to prove that you have very limited functioning and that you require life-sustaining therapy. Okay.
For marked, yes.
Whereas significant means that it can impact your life in a number of ways, but it doesn't necessarily stop you from doing anything. Right? So you can have a significant...
Good description of my disability.
Yeah. Right. Well, the same thing happens with learning disabilities and people with visual impairments and that sort of thing, too. You have people who are blind that have a marked impairment.
Oh.
Right? And then you have people who are visually impaired.
Right.
Okay. That may have a significant impairment, okay, but they're still able to do many visual tasks.
All right.
Same thing. You have people with breathing issues, and you have people that are on oxygen, and that level of function is severely limited.
Right. Right?
So that's just the difference in levels.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah. Interesting. So call up Revenue Canada before the lines get really busy and ask them to send out a T2201 or go down there and pick one up.
No, just go online. If you go online, you can pick up the T2201 as a PDF file. You can download it.
And you can print it.
Yep, you can print it. Or you can even have it as an e-text, and your doctor can actually fill it out online for you.
Yeah. Oh, neat. Okay.
That's as of this year.
It's really accommodating.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, there is also an information package for doctors and professionals that we had the government make up. It's a CD. With like a DVD movie on it, and it talks about all the different parts of the disability tax credit, what can be claimed, how things can be how things can be claimed, who has to claim them, what documentation they need to have, what proofs the doctors need to have, what receipts they need to have for claiming expenses and that sort of thing.
So it's encompassing tax information for people with disabilities, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
It's not something they advertise, but they do have it.
And how do you get it?
You contact the Communications Department for Revenue Canada.
Right.
And then they will send you out a copy of the DVD.
Oh, neat. Okay. How do you get the communications? I mean, I have a hard enough time getting the department that gives you the forms, you know. How do you contact the Communications Department of Revenue?
I will give you the contact so you can broadcast it on a later show if you'd like.
Sure. Yeah, we'll go for that.
So, in fact, I'll even give you a contact for the Communications Department who will gladly give you a copy of the thing.
Okay, so even if you didn't donate at fundraising time, there's a reason to stay tuned. What were you going to tell us about the Registered Disability Savings Plan? Has anything changed with regard to it in the last year?
There's a lot of confusion regarding the Registered Disability Savings Plan.
Yeah, you mentioned an upper age limit, but it's very high.
It's 59.
Right.
Okay, so you can open one up to age 59. Okay, but the government will only contribute the bond amount. They won't triple any of the contributions.
Right.
Okay, and then they'll prorate those contributions for a certain period.
Right.
Okay, and you have to keep it in. If you're on the upper limit, you have to keep it in a minimum of 10 years. So it has to be, if you're 59, it has to stay in there until you're at least 65 to 68.
Okay.
All right. The government RDSP, okay? Not the investment RDSP, but the government RDSP. There are two types.
Oh, okay.
Okay. The government only, government bond only RDSP is not taxable upon remuneration, upon you cashing it in.
All right.
Okay.
Yeah.
It is tax-free at the other end. Okay.
Okay.
But you don't get a tax credit for putting anything in.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
Which is fine because most people who are on disability, which is what it was meant for,
don't pay any tax.
That's right.
Very little. Yeah.
That's right. So the tax credit wouldn't have done them any good.
Okay.
Right. But the tax exempt status at the other end does.
Yeah, intelligent tax law. Who'd have thought?
Yeah. It's not like the Registered Educational Savings Plan where it's just kind of an add-on. This is like a separate program.
Yeah.
Like the RRSP.
Yeah.
Right? With different subsections and everything else. So it's very complicated.
Yeah. Well, I guess it helps to have an advisor mediate or assist your relationship with the bank then when setting one up, so your advisor can be there if the bank has questions or makes inappropriate decisions or draws out the process because they don't know what they're doing at that point.
That would be a good idea, as well as also getting the information off the government website. If you go to Human Resources and Skills Development Canada's website, they go into the RDSP section, print everything off. Because that's the true information. That's what's going on. That's updated weekly.
Weekly? Oh. Yeah.
Yes.
Well, there's changing that much where they have to update it weekly.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right.
You've been listening to Ben Bishop and Bill Schmier, who've been actively working as an arm of the government to help people with disabilities access programs, explain the RDSP and other tax changes. Let's take a short break now. Otis Spann, Get Your Hands Out of My Pocket.
How do y'all go today on the city welfare? Still taking my money, playing me for a square. Hand out of my pocket when I go. For I crank you. Got something to give you, baby. Something you don't expect. Won't be no money, but you won't be no change. Hand out of my pocket when I go. Keep your hand out of my pocket, baby. For I crank you. Thank you. sun. That you love me, I believe you do. Hand out of my pocket, woman. Know that we are through. Keep your hand out of my pocket when I go. Keep your hand out of my pocket, woman, or I crack your head.
Why don't we look at the effectiveness in terms of age brackets so that we can see what eventually what somebody who's very young and is probably the person who was most targeted by this legislation can benefit. Somebody 59 has to keep it till they're 65, 68, and they don't get any additional government contributions. Do they get a bond?
No, they get the $1,000 gets put in every year, regardless if you're on government assistance.
Yeah.
Then the $1,000 is put into the account.
For 10 years?
Yes. A minimum. Okay.
And you mean you put $10?
No, they put $1,000 in.
Government does.
The federal government makes the contribution for you if you're on social assistance.
Oh.
So if you're on CPP disability or ODSP, the government will make your contribution for you.
Okay.
Okay, up until age 69.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh, but you have to stay on somehow on, I don't know that you can stay on CPP disability.
CPP disability, CPP disability doesn't change. Okay, it's just what happens is if you're on ODSP, you go on to OAS, GIS, and a bunch of the other S's.
Yeah.
Okay. But OAS and GIS take over.
Yeah.
Okay. And because you don't get Canada Pension, okay, they know you're on. The RevCan knows that you have transitioned.
Okay.
Okay, and so does Human Resources and Skills
Development. How does it work if you're on CPP disability and ODSP?
You're always on CPP disability even when you hit 65. Yeah. You never transfer.
Till you die.
Yes. CPP disability doesn't switch benefits anymore. They used to, but they don't anymore. It's just because the benefit is...
So that $900,000 a month you get from them is never going to go down.
That's correct.
Yeah.
It's just what we've allowed now, and this is going back 5 years, is that we've allowed ODSP and CPP disability to be combined.
Okay.
So what was happening is if you're on ODSP and CPP disability, what CPP doesn't pay, ODSP tops up.
Right. Okay. So when you turn 65, unlike someone who has to calculate their CPP at that point, your CPP doesn't change.
It just stays.
Just
stays the same. And then you go on OAS and GIS.
Plus CPP.
Right.
What a blessing. What a blessing.
That makes it's an easy transition.
Well, in effect, it's a higher rate, too, for people with disabilities, as some of them anyway.
Well, that's true. You got to remember that people with disabilities don't have any other augmentative pensions.
No, that's true.
Right? So in actuality, it is a higher rate, but they're not actually getting more pension. They're actually they're still below the poverty line.
Way
below the poverty line. Yeah.
Okay. So, all right. So we know what happens to somebody 59 who opens an RDSP.
Right.
Where's the next stepping stone where you are able to get more? Is it 49?
Anything you get, the government, anything you put in, okay, the government will, if it's $1,500 and under that you contribute, the government will triple that contribution.
Okay.
So it's three times.
Okay.
Okay, anything above that, the government doubles it.
Okay.
Okay, up to, I believe it's $5,000.
So if you put $1,000 in, then they'll triple $1,000.
Right. Right. But it's in up to five, and then from $1,500 to $5,000, they'll double it.
Yeah.
Okay. They triple the first $1,500.
You got it.
And then they double the $3,500 after.
You've got it.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, okay.
Right.
And that's from up. Now, is that the bet as good as it gets? Anybody under 49 or anybody 49 and under?
That's as good as it gets, but we've got to understand why the RDSPs were created in the first place. The RDSPs were created so that people with disabilities would have the ability to literally bury themselves with dignity.
Okay.
The reason we had the RDSPs created was because too often people with disabilities were just getting the amount that was offered through CPP disability or ODSP for burial, which basically puts you in a nice little crate and threw you into the nearest thing next to the most polluted pond.
Right.
I think that came from originally when we had one client that was on social assistance, and there was no monies available for burial, and had to settle for what the government would fund for burial.
I think what we've got to realize is that people on disability, especially those people who've had cancer, catastrophic injuries, these people, you know, they go from making X number of dollars a year down to making social assistance, okay?
Which you could fairly characterize as 12,000 and under.
That's right. So they've gone, let's say, from 50,000 to 12,000.
Right.
Okay? And the catastrophe is on the way down.
Yeah, it is.
It's the downward spiral.
Bad enough when you get there, but getting there is the hard part.
So all their savings are all eaten up by the spiral.
Yeah.
Okay, and then ODSP saying that they have to dump everything they've got in order to get the benefits and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
And so they eat up everything until they can't afford to do anything else.
Yeah.
The RDSPs were created for two reasons. One, to soften that downward spiral by allowing them to put in assets up to $230,000 into the RDSPs instead of putting them in Hansen trusts. Secondly, okay, to allow for inheritances, okay, for people that have, you know, well, comfortable families, for them to be able to get their inheritances and again put them into the RDSPs for the same reason, so that they're not eaten up by administration charges of the Hansen Trust or the income trust. Because an income trust requires a lawyer or a trustee to administrate it, and they're allowed to take so much out of the trust for administration fees.
To take a cut of money going in and of money coming out,
that's right.
Up.
So with the RDSP, that's eliminated. Mm-hmm. People get to keep the money.
Also allows for people who go into care as they get older. There is extra money there if they need it for any additional services or anything else they may need while they're in care.
Okay.
So the RDSPs are created as a dignity solution.
Yeah.
Okay, more than anything else. The idea was to maintain the dignity of those people who are on disability.
Okay.
Not to allow these people some measure of life.
Right.
Okay. And also to ease the burdens on the families to take care of those final deaths, take care of whatever problems are out there. There are many times that we've had Revenue Canada chasing corpses. Many times that we've had many times we've had human resources and social development when they were HRDC chasing corpses with the Canada Student Loans Program. We've even had one of the director generals offer to give one of the collection agencies a shovel to go dig someone up to have a conversation. Okay, it's gotten that bad.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I hate to say that our tax money was being used to chase the dead, but it was literally being used to chase the dead. And their families were suffering because sometimes there were times when the families were people on disability themselves.
Right.
So through no fault of their own, they were being denied services because a family member had died, you know, and had the gall to die of cancer or some horrible disease. You know, it's so terrible of them. To die and not leave any provision to pay off those student debts.
Right.
And nobody bothered reporting this to Canada Student Loans or Human Resources and Skills Development. And so their loans were never forgiven.
Right.
Now, there are, and the worst thing is there are actually programs and provisions that allow for that.
Yes, there are. Yeah.
Personal disability benefits and so forth.
Okay.
But the RDSP was created to address this.
Okay.
Right? So that the families don't have to bear the burdens of these expenses. And if there aren't any expenses, then the families can use the money to have a dignified, decent burial for these individuals.
Right.
Right. It really was an very uncharacteristically altruistic moment on the part of Revenue Canada.
Yeah.
Because it was actually Revenue Canada that championed it. Because Revenue Canada has actually been instrumental.
How young can you be and open one up? 18. Your parents? Can your parents open one up earlier?
No.
So 18. You have to be 18. You open it up.
That's right.
Or your guardian if you are not capable.
Yeah, that's correct. Your trustee or guardian, yes.
Okay. So it could have, if you open one up at 18, it could amount to quite a sum of money by the time you are 65.
Well, they put it in for 20 years. That's the top. So $20,000 is the max.
$20,000
is what the maximum contribution that they will put in, yes, for the bond.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
So if you open one at, calling on my arithmetic here, at 39, by 59, you'll have your $20,000 put in. And then you'll be no worse off, except that you have lost 21 years to contribute from the time you were 18.
Yes, but there's another advantage to having it. As say one of your family members dies and leaves you money,
all right,
then that can be dumped into the RDSP. And then that way you don't have any effect at all on your disability benefits because they're automatically exempted.
That also goes for people who are applying for RDSP and that and have a certain amount of money and not enough money to, say, live on for the rest of their life, but enough money where they can take it and they can dump it into the RDSP and then RDSP won't penalize them for a quarter.
Now, if RDSP does penalize them, they can take it to human rights and RDSP will lose.
What would they try to penalize them
for? If they try and compromise their benefits, and I'm going to be very frank about this.
Yeah.
If they try and compromise their benefits for an RDSP contribution of any type.
All right.
Okay, then I urge people to tell ODSP that they are violating the Accessibility for Ontarians with Disabilities Act.
Right.
They are violating the Customer Service Regulation, Section 2C, and they are making an illegal deduction for an exempted program. Okay, the RDSPs are ODSP income exempt.
Okay.
And
what are the penalties that ODSP faces for doing this? What they care is what the inconvenience to them.
$50,000 a day to the worker.
To the worker.
Mm-hmm. These are personal fines. They're administrative penalties that are in the AODA under the administrative under the penalty section.
Okay.
Of the AODA.
And it's just not the worker; it goes up the ladder, all the way up to
the minister herself.
Yes.
You mean they all personally pay $50,000 a day?
Yes, and then the ministry itself has to pay $150
a day.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, very interesting.
The reason for this is because, and it's built into the act. The reason for this is to deter this type of practice. If something is exempted, it is exempted. Okay, the decision has been made by the Premier and by the Minister of Finance to exempt this program and by the Ministry themselves.
Okay.
It's not up to any one worker's
discretion
to challenge those exemptions. That's not their job. Their job is just strictly to administer the program.
Very good. You got any other advice you would like to give to people who are considering their disability benefits and their tax position or their asset position at tax time?
Yes. If you have any assets or anything that's come in, my advice to you is open an RDSP and dump it into the RDSP so it disappears off ODSP's radar. And ODSP will tell you to do the same thing.
Okay.
Okay, because quite frankly, if they don't want to deal with it because that's what the RDSPs are for.
Oh, good.
Okay.
So eventually they'll come to welcome this.
Oh, ODSP, they do, because then income is not the issue. Right?
Yeah.
If somebody leaves you money, then they don't have to deal with it.
So it's not an issue until you take it out and you still have a means
tested
income.
No, if you take it out, it is still exempt.
Oh.
The RDSPs are exempt. And let me be very clear.
So you want to take $50,000 out of an RDSP?
You can take $50,000 out of the RDSP. The RDSPs are income exempt.
Oh, okay.
Okay, and those are written right in the federal and the provincial regulations for the RDSP.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
So you can use it for whatever you want.
My goodness.
All right.
I hope you've been listening to this.
Okay, and if you'd like, I will give Jeff the contact information for the officials in ODSP that you can check this out with. Right. Okay. And the program managers and the appropriate program managers that will be able to answer those questions and will be able to verify what I am saying. But ODSP, and I will even give you the contacts within Revenue Canada who can also verify it.
Yeah, sure.
But the RDSPs are income exempt. And
going in, coming out.
Going in and coming out because they're income exempt and they're tax exempt. Okay, so even when you take the money out, it's not taxable.
So how long has this been true?
Since the beginning of the program.
Which was?
2008.
Yeah. So if you hired an advisor, for instance, to advise you what to do with your inheritance, say, since the beginning of 2008?
There are very few advisors who know enough about the RDSP program to be effective.
That's what I was about to say. If you're going to find an advisor, find somebody who's educated and actually knows what they're doing and to be able to actually assist you.
Off our topic, but is there a remedy if you get someone who doesn't steer you this way and you find out about it, like from our broadcast?
It's like any other program. It's like any other thing, right? It's buyer beware. Okay, you've got to research the people. Make sure that they have experience within the disabled community. Make sure that they understand what the different programs are for the disabled. They understand how they're deployed. They know where the websites are that have the information that govern the programs. Right. Best way of dealing with that is quiz your financial advisor.
Right. Yeah.
Right. Ask them about something you know about. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then wait for him to answer and see if the answers match up. If they don't, then you know the gentleman doesn't know what he's talking about.
Yeah. Maybe a good time for us to mention that David Vlasak brought you in touch with me and is interested in the disability aspect of financial planning enough to have listened to you about what you have to say as well.
With CFF, we do not endorse any organization or any person. We have no stake in anybody giving any services. But there is one thing that I will say. Life trust planning under David Vlasak and Bank of Montreal were the only two financial institutions that went to the last disability awareness event in 2007 that bothered to show up for the disability awareness event. And I will say again, they were the only ones that bothered to show up.
And there was a number of them invited, so...
Oh, really?
Bank of Nova Scotia was invited. Royal Bank was invited. Yep. Manulife Financial was invited. Architect Society was invited. The only ones that showed up were Bank of Montreal and Life Trust Planning.
Okay.
And subsequently, Bank of Montreal was the first bank to do the RDSPs.
Okay. Well, if that wraps it up for this pre-tax interview, pre-tax filing interview, we'll get those numbers from you for people to further verify the information and maybe follow up on some details that they haven't located the answers to on the web, and we'll give them out over the air on a subsequent broadcast.
And I will say again that even the information we have might even be dated. They might have even changed it again. So definitely check the websites. Definitely check the HRSD website on the Human Resources and Skills Development website on the RDSP. Very important. Check. Do not check the bank sites. Check the government site. Okay, because the government is the one that administers the program. Is the one that actually is in charge of the program. The banks just administer it.
Okay.
Okay, they're like subcontractors.
Thanks very much, Ben, and thank you, Bill.
All right.
And now it's time for Disrespect's weekly review of the news. Remember, these are not the articles that we read to you. These are condensations or abridgments of the articles. You'll find the full article in the newspapers that we mention on the broadcast. As I speak, until Friday, March the 19th, 5 McMaster University Commerce students are involved in a 5-day homeless program. The goal for the students is to generate awareness within the community about homelessness, as well as promote humanitarianism. The group is living outside the Student Center until Friday. And in the Toronto Star, Monday, March 15th, Ruth Bramham, Project Coordinator, Planning and Renovations, York University, in the Letters segment. Who will fund accessibility compliance? So, the federal government has ratified the UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. Ontario's Accessibility for Ontarians with Disabilities Act, passed by the legislature in 2005, finally saw the beginning of its implementation January 1st this year. But where is the funding to ensure full compliance? The costliest part of ensuring implementation is still awaiting final approval, the Accessible Built Environment Standards. Meetings held over the past year or so brought only questions on where the funding would be found to implement ABES. Public and institutional buildings have only 3 years to be in compliance, yet we still don't know the final form of the standards. Building owners and managers want to make their buildings fully accessible and safe for those with all forms of disability. As a member of the committee formed to ensure York's compliance, it would be nice to know what standards to meet, a realistic deadline, and how to pay for all the changes. And from the Canadian Press, brain-damaged baby dies in parents' arms after being taken off ventilator. Edmonton, surrounded by family, a brain-injured baby died in the arms of his loving parents in hospital after they'd spent months trying everything in their power to keep him alive. Rebecca and Isaac May went to court in January seeking to prevent doctors from unhooking their son, Isaiah, from a ventilator until they could get a second independent medical opinion. When those experts told them there was no hope their boy would ever recover, they made a decision no parent should ever face. The 5-month-old boy died shortly after noon, Thursday, March 11th, only hours after his young parents were to appear in court again about the independent medical review of his condition. The hearing was canceled. Isaiah has been a blessing to us, and his spirit will always be in our hearts, said the parents in a statement read by their lawyer, Rosanna Sakamani. We will never forget the miracle of his birth, the Christmas we spent together, and the early spring day when we said our goodbyes. We will always cherish our son and the gift of time with him. We've set our tiny miracle free, and he's now home in the arms of the angels. And from Denise Davey at The Spectator, parents of autistic children fear they have a new battle to fight. IBI, or Intensive Behavioral Intervention, can be highly effective in helping autistic children develop speech and language skills. Most parents face waits of 2 or even 3 years for IBI. Those who can afford it are the ones who will be affected by HST on top of that cost. Paul Ceretti of Hamilton was one of about 15 parents who attended a news conference at Queen's Park to protest the tax being imposed on IBI. One of Ceretti's twin daughters, Delaney, was cut off IBI last year because she was said not to be benefiting from it. Her twin, Mackenzie, continues to receive treatment at home. Ceretti would not be affected by the tax as he receives government-funded IBI. NDP leader Andrea Horvath slammed the Liberal government in Queen's Park about taxing the treatment. Horvath said the Ministry of Finance has reported that IBI therapy may only be exempt if the psychologist is registered with the Canadian Register of Health Service Providers in Psychology. However, she said the Ministry of Child and Youth Services eliminated this as a requirement for parents obtaining IBI. Quote, this comes on top of all the other pressures the McGuinty government has heaped on families with a child with autism, said Horvath. Again, Toronto Star, Monday, March 15th, John Spears, business reporter. No payoff in time of use conservation. Laura Seddon thought she was doing everything right to save electricity and reduce her costs. She made sure all the lights in her Scarborough home had energy-efficient compact fluorescent bulbs. She bought an energy-efficient gas dryer. And when she was switched to time-of-use pricing, by which customers are charged higher rates for using power during peak periods, she shifted almost 60% of her consumption to the lowest-priced periods of the week. Yet she's now paying an average of 6.2 cents per kilowatt-hour, while a year ago she paid 5.6 cents. The price refers only to the electricity line of the bill. Added delivery regulatory and debt retirement charges don't vary by time of day. Most Toronto householders are now on time-of-use rates, some 460,000 of Toronto Hydro's 580,000 residential customers. Many are now getting their first or second bills under the new system and comparing costs, and some, like Seddon, are unhappy. I don't like this new system, she said. It's been promoted as if people are going to be rewarded for making an effort, but making an effort does not have any rewards. Ontario Energy Minister Brad Duguid said the main objective of time-of-use pricing is not to save consumers money, although some will achieve modest savings. But more important, and this is what the goal is, their time of use has shifted, Duguid said in an interview. High demand at peak times also forces power companies to build expensive generators that may run only a few hours a day, a few months a year. The money for those plants has to be built into the overall price of power. Shifting time of use is a very effective and efficient way to save overall on our energy costs, says Duguid. This is probably one of the most cost-effective ways to keep our prices moderate and our future building needs less than they otherwise would have been. The savings in Seddon's three-person household, herself, her husband, and son, are modest. They cut consumption by 13% compared with the same period a year ago. 59% of their usage is at the lowest rate, only 24% at the peak rate. Yet the bill dropped only 4%. Her bill averages out to 6.2 cents a kilowatt hour this year, or 10.7% more per kilowatt than she paid a year ago. What irked her was a brochure she got with her bill stating time-of-use pricing rewards you for using electricity during low-demand periods, whenever possible. Seddon doesn't see it that way. A 10% increase is not a reward, she said. It's another money grab. I'd rather they just said we're hiking rates, and not if you're an ecological responsible person, we're going to reward you. They're not. To keep the bill at the same level, you have to use extreme measures. Toronto Star, Monday, March 15th. Carol Gore. Have the poor fallen off the agenda? The bad omens keep coming. The first was the federal speech from the throne on March 3rd. Although Stephen Harper's government pledged not to balance the book by cutting transfer payments for health care and education, it did not mention the third purpose of federal transfers, social assistance. Next came the federal budget on March the 4th. The message was identical. We will not balance the budget by cutting transfer payments for health care or education. Finance Minister Jim Flaherty did not rule out shoring up welfare. The provinces have the right to spend transfer payments as they wish, but he certainly made Ottawa's preferences clear. The biggest disappointment was Ontario's speech from the throne on March the 8th. It didn't contain a word about social assistance, also known as welfare. There was one passing reference to Premier McGuinty's goal of reducing poverty by 25% by 2013, but beyond that, low-income Ontarians were overlooked. The final event in the cycle, the most important one, is the provincial budget, March 25th. It will end the uncertainty about social assistance rates, affordable housing, and subsidized childcare. Most anti-poverty groups are holding their fire right now. The 25 and 5 Network, a province-wide coalition of social activists, issued a brief statement after the throne speech urging McGuinty to keep his commitments and be there for the vulnerable when help is needed most. A couple of tenant organizations expressed alarm. The Ontario Coalition for Better Childcare called on its members to blitz MPPs with letters stressing that subsidized childcare is essential to get struggling parents back on their feet. Overall, however, the reaction to the throne speech was remarkably muted. McGuinty is hinting that better news will come next week. He talks about helping the vulnerable and upholding Ontario's traditions of compassion and inclusiveness. But judging from the Ontario Premier's track record, that could mean anything from promises to hold more consultations and set more targets to a checklist of everything the McGuinty government has already done or will do for low-income Ontarians this year. It reduced provincial income tax rates in January to prepare for the introduction of the harmonized sales tax in July. It will boost the monthly Ontario child benefit from $67 to $75 a month in July. And it is phasing in full-day kindergarten for four-year-olds, all of which have been announced in the past. But social assistance rates remain 60% below Statistics Canada's low-income cutoff 7 years after the Liberals took power. An individual receives $585 per month, $364 for shelter, and $221 for, quote, basic needs, unquote. The McGuinty government has yet to deliver its 10-year provincial housing strategy. Two housing ministers have come and gone. Medical officers of health across the province have been calling since 2007 for a basic nutrition allowance so social assistance recipients can eat properly. They've been met with silence. Full-day kindergarten for four-year-olds will benefit low-income parents who have a child who qualifies. But this help could come at the expense of toddlers and three-year-olds whose childcare facilities may be squeezed out of elementary schools. Municipalities, too, are poised to reduce their subsidized childcare spaces for lack of funds. As budget day approaches, anti-poverty groups aren't expecting much. They know times are tough. They know education, not poverty reduction, is McGuinty's priority. They know the poor are always told to wait when there is a deficit. They'd like to trust the Premier, but all the harbingers look bleak. And now a break with Otis Spann. Once more, You Can't Hide. And from Vancouver, Globe and Mail, Saturday, March the 6th, Gary Mason. Post-Olympics spotlight falls on housing dilemma. Olympians in Vancouver for the 2010 Winter Games loved staying in the Athletes Village. Big surprise. Their rooms will be soon retrofitted, in some cases sold, for millions of dollars. Another Athletes Village as nice as the one in Vancouver built is unlikely in the next 100 years. But as soon as the Paralympics conclude later this month, attention will once again focus on the economics of the development and how much of the nearly $1 billion of Vancouver taxpayers spent to bail out the project they are likely to get back. One of the more contentious aspects of the discussion is certain to involve the status and future of the 252 units of social housing to which the city had committed itself. It is a promise now likely to be broken. On one side are those who say the social housing is too expensive and would be better built far cheaper somewhere else. On the other are those who believe the city has a moral imperative to honor its obligation to make room for the poor in all big real estate developments. Estimates show it would cost an additional $55 million to $75 million to subsidize the housing, keeping rents far below market value over a period of 30 years or so as originally planned. The social housing component of the project was supposed to cost about $65 billion. It ballooned to $110 million. The worst cost overruns of the Olympic Village construction involved the three parcels of units set aside for social housing. it would arguably be the most expensive social housing anywhere in the world. Complicating the issue is the fact the city could still end up losing $100 million or more from its stake in the project. The city had to bail out the developer to the tune of about $900 million after the original lender, Fortress Investment Group, decided to bail because of nervousness about overruns. Now, given the bounce back in the economy and the positive exposure the Olympic Village received during the Games, there is a much stronger likelihood Millennium Development will be able to repay all of its building loan. But that still leaves $170 million that it owes the city for the land upon which the project is built. It's entirely possible the city will not get that back. This creates a problem because it was counting on that money to pay for the $160 million it spent on other infrastructure investments related to the project, such as soil remediation, a civic center, a plaza, and other improvements. Even if the city were to get half the money back, that still amounts to an $87 million loss, which makes it that much harder to justify spending possibly $180 million for 252 units of social housing. At the moment, City Council favors the 252 units to be rented out at rates slightly under market, possibly for 7 to 10 years. At the end of that time, a decision would be made as to what portion would convert to social housing while selling the rest as condos at market value. The money saved by going this route would be used to build more social housing on another site at a much more cost-effective rate. Jim Green, the legendary community development consultant, will not be thrilled with this solution. Mr. Green rejects any plan perceived as concentrating low-income people in one area, creating what he calls massive ghettos. I don't think that's what the city has in mind. Nonetheless, that is a sentiment that it would face if it takes this option. Whatever happens, it seems certain now the Olympic Village won't have 252 units of social housing. This will be the biggest, most controversial decision Vancouver's Vision government will make, the fallout from which may be felt into the next election. In Hamilton Spectator, Friday, March the 12th, Emma Riley. Bertina quits Housing Board. Denies information was confidential. Councillor Bob Bertina has resigned from the City Housing Hamilton Board over concerns he distributed confidential information. But Bertina, who joined the board late last year, said the information was public and concerned the well-being of his residents. The events that prompted the Ward 2 councillor's departure began when he received statistics on how many times police had been called to city housing properties. He said police had answered about 1,000 calls at 3 city housing properties over the past year. Bertina then shared those statistics with the Durand Neighbourhood Association as he felt the public had a right to see information involving its neighbourhood. "My opinion is it's not confidential information," he said. However, Bertina said the board members felt he should have asked permission to publicize the statistics. They also questioned whether the statistics were intended to be kept confidential. They were not presented at an in-camera meeting. Bertina said he resigned because he couldn't improve the quality of life for city housing tenants if he couldn't be upfront about the issues they face. Let's put it this way. "I'm not as interested in projecting an image of city housing as I am in dealing with the problems," he said. "If I'm not going to be able to deal candidly and publicly with the problems that the residents and their neighbors are having, then I shouldn't be on the board." Bertina sent an email to City Housing Board President Councillor Brian McHattie earlier this week offering his resignation. McHattie believes Bertina made the right decision. "When you're on a board, you're a board member. You have to leave the Ward 2 hat at the door." And from letters to the editor at the Spectator, Peter Llewellyn in Hamilton. "Rampant crime ruins public housing for most. Re: Bertina quits Housing Board. Denies information was confidential on March the 12th. "I've been a tenant for a decade in a social housing complex the police service has attended 1,000 times in the last year. I witness the nonsense that occurs daily in these city-owned buildings. The board of directors and management for Hamilton's social housing provider have never been interested in the quality of life for tenants and the surrounding neighborhoods, and the facts appear to support this. Crime is rampant. Prostitution, drug dealing, property crimes, and violence are daily occurrences at the intersection where this complex is. The annual turnover rate is 30% year after year. These are not the bad tenants being evicted. They rarely are. The people who leave are tenants who have given up trying to leave peacefully in the only housing they can readily afford. The people involved in operating this subsidized housing, both management and the housing board, can do better. They just are not willing to do so. And from the Canadian Press, by Jennifer Ditchburn. Internet program takes a hit. Libraries, hospitals, rural areas hurt as Ottawa cuts funding. The Conservative government is quietly cutting funding to hundreds of community groups and even hospitals that provide free internet access to Canadians who might not otherwise have a chance to get online. Organizations that benefit from Industry Canada's 16-year-old community access program began receiving letters last week informing them that sites located within 25 kilometers of a public library would no longer be eligible for cash. Groups have been receiving between $4,000 and $5,000 a year to buy computers and other hardware such as printers and wireless routers, to pay for technical support and skills training, and sometimes to pay for the connection bills. Organizations that have used the program include employment and youth drop-in centers, English as a second language programs, libraries, and seniors groups. In rural areas, such organizations are often clustered in the middle of town and near the local library, meaning they are the most likely to be hit by the change in funding criteria. Even in industry, Minister Tony Clement's writing, the West Parry Sound Health Center administered funds for 46 different community sites that will likely see their funding disappear because they don't fit the new narrow criteria. Said Karen DeLuca of the Arnprior Public Library in Eastern Ontario, "It's a vital link for everyone. It puts everyone on the same footing across Canada," said DeLuca, "who see people come in to draft resumes, download programs, or do homework. There are still many rural communities who still do not have high-speed access at home." Industry Canada did not immediately respond to questions about changes to the program, including the size of the cut. Details did not appear on Industry Canada's website or in the recent federal budget documents, which have been touting the government's new work on a digital economy strategy. The Conservatives are spending $200 million on expanding broadband coverage to underserved households in Canada. Gary Goodyear, Minister of State for Science and Technology, told the House of Commons that public libraries and 80% of Canadians now have internet access. Liberal MP Anthony Rota, Vice Chair of the Commons Committee on Industry, Science and Technology, wants to know where that leaves the other 20% of the population. And from the Saturday Globe and Mail, columnist Tabba Southey has written a full-page column, Offside Calls on Jason Kenney. For Canada's new Citizenship and Immigration Study Guide to stay at its current length and include the words same-sex marriage was legalized nationally in 2005. Words cut, we learned last week, under Immigration Minister Jason Kenney's watch, although not, he insists, by his authority. We would have had to lose the words Canadian children have collected hockey cards for generations. And then where would we be? True, everything else about hockey could have remained in the guide. New immigrants would still have been able to learn that many young Canadians play hockey at school, in a hockey league, or on quiet streets, road hockey or street hockey, and are taken to the hockey rink by their parents. Note the clarity here surrounding the definition of hockey played on the streets. This sport is known colloquially as either road or street hockey. Obviously, this exactitude is important because the whole two words for a type of thoroughfare on which one might play hockey situation that admittedly exists in this country might have thrown a lot of new Canadians off. That's booklet space well used. But I'm concerned there's no specific mention to shinny in the guide. I seek reassurances from the minister that this will be addressed in the next printing. However, if these same immigrants, aware that hockey is Canada's most popular spectator sport and is considered to be the national winter sport, even though it is not, were then later faced with an actual hockey card, an entirely foreign artifact to many people, they might become confused, possibly violent. And if a new immigrant were to find, say, a 1979 O'Peachy No. 18 Wayne Gretzky rookie card inside an old issue of Mad magazine at a yard sale, he might not recognize its extraordinary monetary value. He might use it as a bookmark instead of buying a cottage with it. And we can't have that. So good call there, Minister Kenny. And it's great to see a shout out by way of the guide's hockey card mentioned to that cottage industry that is the National Hockey League. Returning to the road hockey issue, I'd like the next guide to explain what it means when someone shouts, "Car!" That shouldn't be overlooked. Including "car" could be a lifesaver. In fact, I predict that if Parliament continues to be prorogued with the frequency and increasing casualness it has been, 2 years down the road, the Prime Minister will only have to rise in the House and shout, "Car!" and the government will adjourn on the spot. Canada, by the way, is one of only 7 countries in the world in which same-sex and opposite-sex marriages have equal standing in law. However, we are one of only 4 countries in the world in which hockey cards are routinely traded. Before you judge Mr. Kenny, a long-standing opponent of same-sex marriage who is considered to be, and actually is, our immigration minister, and who either by inattention or design included the hockey card information and excluded any reference to same-sex marriage, take a moment to imagine that you come from a country in which it's not acceptable to trade hockey cards. Imagine you were raised somewhere you'd be discriminated against or beaten senseless or risk untimely death because of your hockey card collection. Or that you yourself, while uninterested in collecting cards, beat other people in your homeland with impunity the second you discovered that they owned a deck. Now imagine yourself reading that statement in our immigration guide. Canadian children have collected hockey cards for generations. Why, that would change everything, I believe. I'm sure that there are people who'd think that alone warranted the glorious and free in our anthem. Others, upon reading it, will have learned one of our culture's rules. Either way, it's a great bonus question on the test. We should think up a few more. And that's the news this week for Disrespect. Come back next week and there will be more. And to take us out, Otis Spann at his instrumental best, GB Blues. If you can't access a Disrespect broadcast, you can now listen to the show wherever you're near an internet download. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number 4, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at showtime to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.